for that, Shabir Rizvi. I do apologize for jumping in. Political and economic analyst there from London. Thank you, Shabir. Also, journalist and commentator James Sweedy from Plymouth, UK. Thank you so much. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. For me, Kawitawe and the team, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربك سريع العقاب وإن إنه لغفور رحيم صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return. So He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran warns the EU against taking hasty political measures based on false accusations, promising reciprocal action in response to such moves. Negative economic data could be tipping the United States towards recession ahead of the pivotal midterm elections in which the control of Congress will be at stake. Also coming up, North Korea fires two short-range ballistic missiles following joint drills by South Korea and the United States in the region. Thank you for joining us. We begin right here in Iran, where the country has warned the European Union against taking hasty political measures based on unfounded accusations to embolden rioters and terrorists targeting Iranian people. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remarks in a phone call with the bloc's foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell. His statements came a day after the bloc said it was mulling restrictive measures against Tehran in the wake of recent riots. Iran's top diplomat said Tehran respects people's right to hold peaceful protests, but will take firm legal measures against rioters and terrorists. For his part, Borrell admitted that rioting and terrorism are different from peaceful protests that need an appropriate response. He added that the bloc does not intend to cause problems in its relations with the Islamic Republic. Riots erupted after a young woman died at hospital after being taken by police. A thorough investigation is underway to ascertain the exact cause of her death. British police have released images of anti-Iran protesters who were present at a violent riot outside Iran's London embassy, which saw police officers wounded and the building vandalized. Amid the manhunt, Robert Carter highlights the continued threat Western-based anti-Iran dissident groups pose on Britain's streets.
British police have released images of individuals they want to identify in connection with the recent anti-Iran riots opposite Iran's embassy in London. The London Metropolitan Police have already admitted that five officers were seriously injured during clashes with demonstrators on September the 25th. The protesters claimed to support Iranian woman Marza Amini, who collapsed at a police station in Tehran on September the 16th. A spokesperson for the Met said,
"We won't tolerate members of the public or officers who are doing all they can to maintain and regain order being injured in any circumstances. And we are now doing everything we can to make sure those who committed the violent offences are brought to justice."
Police are now guarding the embassy and consulate building, but other sites remain fearful of future attacks too. The Islamic Centre of England in Maidvale was also targeted in the recent riots.
There's been so many cases where these so-called Iranians, these, you know, pro-Iranians have come and they've ripped off women's hijabs and they've beat up little girls and they've smashed in people's heads. It's just ridiculous.
The recent protests saw a hodgepodge of rival ideologies and dissident groups banding together. Many of these groups have a history of conducting violent attacks against Iranian expats living in the West. We witnessed supporters of the anti-Iran terrorist group, the MKO, and former Shah dictatorship supporters verbally and physically assaulting Iranians attempting to vote in London back in June 2021.
I heard a rock hit the ground. I didn't look back because I was shaking at that time as well, and it hit my trainer, a bit of it. And then they're calling names. One of them said to me, and funnily enough, the policeman was there, but obviously you couldn't understand Farsi. He's telling me if I had a knife, I would cut you in pieces right here, right now.
Calm has returned to London streets for the time being. However, many of the dissident groups which took part in the recent riots remain active and at large, acting as opportunists, willing to jump on any opportunity to harass ordinary Iranian expats and seemingly anyone else who stands in their way. Robert Carter, London.
For nearly a decade, Albania has been accommodating members of MKO, an anti-Iran terror group behind the killing of thousands of Iranian civilians. Now, the Balkan country acknowledges that the group should not do any political activity on its soil. The Albanian Minister of Infrastructure and Energy claims her country is hosting the MKO on humanitarian grounds. Belinda Beluka says the group is not allowed to do any activity beyond what it had agreed with the Albanian government. The MKO has conducted numerous assassinations and bombings against Iranian statesmen and civilians since the 1979 victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution. Despite its decades-long acts of terror, the EU and the US have dropped the group from their list of foreign terrorist organizations. In the US, a new court ruling has once again thrown the fate of a program protecting undocumented migrants into question. An appeals court has ruled that the deferred action for childhood arrivals is unlawful and needs to be reviewed. A panel of three judges has affirmed a lower court's ruling against the program known as DACA. President Joe Biden has criticized the ruling, saying it's the result of continued efforts by Republicans to strip the migrants who entered the country as children of their rights. His administration's policy is to allow DACA beneficiaries known as Dreamers to live and work in the U.S. DACA was instituted in 2012 by then-President Barack Obama, but Donald Trump later tried to dismantle it, insisting that Obama had exceeded his constitutional powers. The policy will now go back to a lower court for review. Staying in the U.S., where the negative economic data continues to pile up, 5 weeks into the midterms, a record plunge in the number of job openings has many declaring that the country is officially in a recession. Ramin Mazahari has more from Chicago.
New jobs data in the United States showed a collapse of 1.1 million job openings, the biggest one-month crash ever outside of the COVID lockdown. It's also the first increase in the unemployment rate since April 2020, and that has many so-called recession deniers being forced to reconsider. The United States has had two consecutive quarters of negative economic growth, which is the standard definition of economic recession. However, in an effort to avoid the negative press the recession label receives, the administration of President Joe Biden claimed that a stable unemployment rate meant that the U.S. was not in a recession. That's no longer possible. Due to the so-called Uberization of the United States economy, the official data has long been accused of falsely portraying a rosy picture. The national unemployment rate is 4%, but many say the jobs available are part-time or lack crucial benefits like health care, or are poorly paid despite the current record inflation.
People looking for benefits, they want to work from home. People are not settling like they used to. It's just a matter of, I don't want to say laziness, but I think people are just, they're trying to get the best that they want, and companies are trying to hold steady and their wages, and they're not willing to pay as much because costs are going up for them as well.
Amid the backfiring of Western sanctions on Russia, many businesses have responded by cutting job listings, slowing the hiring process, and may begin mass layoffs. The widespread perception is that America's central bank is forcing a recession to reduce inflation, even if that means throwing millions out of work, out of their homes, and guts pensions, which are usually based on the stock market. The drop in jobs is the latest piece of data which shows a dangerously worsening economic situation for the average American. Wages are losing ground to inflation at a record pace, and an economically chaotic October could translate into a painful holiday season for many. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
A new report by the FBI shows that cases of murder and manslaughter continue to rise in the U.S. The new data shows that the number of murders increased over 4% last year compared to the year before. The actual number could even be higher, as the report excludes data related to the nation's two largest cities, New York and Los Angeles. The Bureau added that the vast majority of homicides were committed using some type of firearms. Experts say the Bureau's findings show that violent crime remains a significant problem in the country. The U.S. has been seeing a rising number of murders in recent years. 2 years ago, during the pandemic, homicides saw a surge of almost 30%. The rising crime rate has also become a hot topic for political debates, as Republicans focus their campaign on concerns about crime ahead of the midterm elections. South Korea and Japan say the North has fired two short-range ballistic missiles amid escalating tensions on the Korean Peninsula. According to the South Korean military, the missiles were fired from Pyongyang towards the country's east coast and in the direction of Japan. This is North Korea's sixth missile launch in 12 days and the first since it fired an intermediate-range missile over Japan. North Korea's foreign ministry on Thursday said recent missile launches were, quote, counteraction measures against joint military drills by the U.S. and South Korea. It added that the joint drills escalate military tensions on the Korean Peninsula. Pyongyang considers such moves as rehearsals for an invasion. It accuses the U.S. and its regional allies of threatening it with war games and military buildup. The Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, and its Russian-led allies have announced a big cut in oil production from the coming November, defying U.S. pressure. During a meeting in Vienna, the 23 countries, together known as OPEC Plus, agreed to reduce the output by 2 million barrels per day to boost a crude market already reeling from the global economic crisis. That's over 2% of the global oil production and comes amid soaring energy prices. The move prompted a blistering reaction from the White House. In a statement, Washington expressed disappointment over what it called a short-sighted decision by the cartel. It said the president would consult with Congress to reduce OPEC's control over energy prices. The U.S. already warned the cartel against the crippling consequences of the measure for the world economy. Turning now to the latest developments in the Ukraine war, President Volodymyr Zelensky says his forces have retaken some areas in the southern Kherson region from Russian troops. According to Zelensky, three settlements near the city of Kherson have been liberated. The advances were made after the latest maps revealed by Moscow showed Russian troops had left many areas in Kherson and the northeastern Kharkiv region. Kiev launched a counteroffensive in the beginning of September and says it has so far taken back thousands of square kilometers of Russian-controlled territory. That includes the strategic town of Lyman in the eastern Donetsk region, which was a logistics and transport hub for Moscow's operations. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov has said the areas recaptured by Kiev will eventually return to Russia. Meanwhile, the UN General Assembly is preparing to hold a vote on Russia's recent annexation of four Ukrainian regions. Soaring energy prices in Italy continue to bite. The Italian Retailers Association has announced that hundreds of thousands of firms are at risk of closure next year as recession looms on the country's economic horizon.
On Wednesday, Italy's largest retailers association, Confcommercio, warned that over 120,000 small businesses risk shutting down in the first half of 2023. The association said firms are squeezed by the cost of living and skyrocketing energy prices. The president of Confcommercio, Carlo Sangalli, urged the government to do more to shield small and medium entrepreneurs, as the situation for many is now very critical.
There is the risk of a high number of business closures in the coming 9 months. Some small firms will simply find it more convenient to suspend their activity rather than losing 200 to 300 euros a day. Having said that, Italy will soon face a mild recession, which frankly is not as worrying as the media depict it.
Last month, Italy's outgoing government approved an aid package worth some 14 billion euros in an attempt to shield firms and families from surging energy costs. The measure came on top of over 50 billion euros already budgeted since January to soften the energy crisis in the country. However, the aid seems to be insufficient as an increasing number of businesses are struggling to stay afloat.
Everything costs at least 20% more. Energy prices keep soaring and it is very hard to keep going. We need help. The government must do something.
I cannot afford paying expenses for my family. I have four dependent children. They're all unemployed. Bills keep going up. How do we cope?
According to Confcommercio, more than 370,000 jobs are at risk as a result of the energy crisis. Meanwhile, energy giant Eni announced that gas supplies to Italy from Russia have resumed after 4 days. Russia's state-controlled Gazprom cut off gas supplies to Italy on Saturday, citing a problem linked to regulatory changes in Austria. Italy's national energy regulator, ARERA, warned last week that prices would climb by almost 60% by the end of the year, but experts argue that its estimate was optimistic. Bills have risen by 93% in Italy over the past 2 years, and the conflict between Russia and Ukraine, together with the damage recently sustained by Nord Stream pipelines, is likely to push costs even higher. Max Civili, Rome.
Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee, so recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday 5 things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Beginning of the Savior's mission. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. Heartiest felicitations to our dear listeners on a very auspicious day, since today happens to be the 9th of Rabiul Awwal, which marks the start of the divinely designated mission of the 12th and last infallible heir of the Almighty's last and greatest messenger, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. He is the Prophet's namesake and was a boy of only 5 years old when orphaned the day before, on the 8th of Rabiul Awwal, in the year 260 AH, corresponding to 874 AD, in the Iraqi city of Samarra, on the martyrdom through poisoning of his father, Imam Hassan Askari, peace upon him. The divine mantle of Imamat came to rest on his tender shoulders under circumstances when the self-styled caliph of the usurper Abbasid regime, after assassinating his father, was bent upon finding him and, if possible, murder him as well. But by the grace of Allah, who bestowed prophethood upon Jesus, peace upon him, while still a boy in the cradle, and saved him from the conspiracies of the Israelites, the 12th Imam went into occultation and will reappear as Qa'imul Mahdi in the end times to cleanse the planet of all vestiges of oppression and corruption by establishing the global government of peace, prosperity, and justice. This has been promised in the Noble Quran. Orphaned at the tender age of 5, Divine Providence willed that his imamat continue in the state of occultation. As a matter of fact, minor occultation, or Qaybatul Sughra, during which period he was hidden from the prying eyes of the usurpers of the caliphate, who had launched a manhunt to trace him out and murder him, in view of the Prophet's famous statement that the number of his righteous successors will number 12, and the last one will rise as Qa'imul Mahdi. Nevertheless, he kept secret contact with the followers of the Ahlul Bayt through the well-organized system of wakalat, or representation, headed by deputies who succeeded one another and numbered 4. The Abbasids shuddered at the thought of his return, which God willed should be prolonged for several centuries as Qaybatul Kubra, or major occultation, as a trial for mankind, as a respite for the doubters to reform and rectify their beliefs, and as a hope for the believers to look forward to his eventual reappearance without the least pessimism, after having endured the blessings of unwavering awaiting that no propaganda of the faithless, no plot of hypocrites, and no treason of the takfiris could undermine. The one promised by God, foretold by the Messenger of Mercy, as both Shia and Sunni sources of hadith testify, and expected in all religions as the deliverer of humanity, will indeed reappear when the world would be brimming with violence, bloodshed, treachery, and all sorts of injustices, as the trend of events of our times indicate. He will make his advent at the Holy Kaaba, the symbolic house of the one and only Creator. He will stand between Ruknul Yamani and the Maqamul Ibrahim, or the station of Prophet Abraham, and call 5 times for redemption of justice, that is, istighathe, or appeal in the divine court for help. The first phrase of his istighase would be, "Know, O people of the world, I am Imam Al-Qa'im." The second phrase of the Imam's istighase will be, "Know, O people of the world, I am the avenging sword." Here some questions arise.
for whose innocent blood will Imam Mahdi will be the avenging sword? Who was the person whom beasts in human form brutally martyred? For whom do the faithful continue to shed tears while making pilgrimage to his shrine, even at the risk posed to their life by the dastardly devils of every divisionist doctrine, such as the Zionists, the Wahhabis, the Salafis, and cannibalistic Takfiris? The answers to these questions are provided in the third, fourth, and fifth phrases of the Istighatha of Imam Mahdi, peace upon him, who will proclaim from the precincts of the Holy Kaaba. Know, O people of the world, indeed, my ancestor, Imam Hussein, was slain in the state of acute thirst. The next phrase will be, Know, O people of the world, surely my ancestor Imam Hussein lay bare without a shroud or burial. The last phrase of the Istighatha of Imam Mahdi, peace upon him, on his reappearance at the Holy Kaaba will be, Know, O people of the world, the bare body of my ancestor Imam Hussein was trampled by the Umayyad horsemen. True believers from all over the world will rally to the Imam's call on his reappearance, which would be preceded by five definite signs, according to a statement from the Prophet's sixth infallible heir, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him, who says, Before the uprising of Imam Mahdi, peace upon him, there will be five certain signs. Uprising of the Yemeni, the Sufyani, the call from the sky, martyrdom of Nafs Zakiyya, or the pure soul, and the rift in the desert, where the earth will swallow an army sent to Hejaz by the enemies of the Ahlul Bayt. This hadith is ample proof that the Arabian Peninsula would be cleared of the evil presence of the Wahhabis, especially the ruling Saudi Najdi family of brigands with Jewish roots, who are masquerading as Muslims in order to destroy the spirit of Islam through their collaboration with the US and the Zionists, and their open enmity with the followers of the Prophet's Ahlul Bayt. Another point to note is the Islamic Revolution in Yemen and preparation of Yemeni Muslims for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi, peace upon him, along with flags of the East from Khorasan, Iran, that will converge on Iraq to save the country from the bloody hordes of Sufyani, who would be unleashing bloodbaths in Syria. It is mentioned that Sana'a will be the capital of the Islamic movement in Yemen, and its leader will be from the progeny of Zayd the Martyr, the son of Imam Ali ibn Hussein Zainul Abidin, peace upon him. Imam Mahdi, peace upon him, will arrive in Iraq to save the people from the sedition of the Sufyani and his bloodthirsty invaders from Syria. Mahdi, peace upon him, will have as his lieutenant Prophet Jesus, peace upon him, who will also reappear and disown Christianity, which means most of the Europeans and Americans, having rid themselves of the despots in the White House and the despicable Zionists, would by then become God-fearing believers, receptive to the universal mission of Islam, as preached by the 12th Imam, whose mother was the spotlessly pure Lady Narges, as granddaughter of the Byzantine Emperor and a direct descendant through her mother of Simon, one of the 12 disciples of the virgin-born Messiah. Dear listeners, we end our program with a supplication to the Lord Most High. O Allah, make him the refuge for your oppressed servants and a helper for him who has no other helper besides you, and the reviver of the commandments in your book, which has been neglected, and a strengthener of the sciences in your religion and the way of your prophet. May Allah's blessing be upon him and his progeny. O Allah, enable us to witness his days, his appearance, and his rising, and appoint us to be among his helpers, avenging the martyrs alongside him. Write us among his supporters and dedicated friends. Bring us to life in his reign, prosperous, enriched by his company, defending his cause, and secure from all ills. O most merciful of the merciful, all praise belongs to Allah, the Lord of all the worlds, and may his blessings be on your master, Muhammad, the seal of the prophets and envoys, and on his progeny and kindred, the truthful ones. O God, may your curse be on all oppressors. Judge between us and them, O the fairest of all judges.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Why Syria? Part 2.
Nine years is not a short period.
It's similar to the period of a child who was born and is now a couple of years into school, or a teenager who is now admitted to university, or a student who has graduated, is married, and is now likely expecting his first child. And so that's the way I prefer to look at the passing of 9 years. But in Syria, I couldn't look the way I wanted to at the passing of 9 years, as I passed the streets, alleyways, and buildings. I could only keep myself composed to some extent, as opposed to many others who were in shock and awe when they encountered these scenes. Especially when I saw all of those factories and workshops that used to be full of workers, engineers, and technicians 9 years ago. People who are no longer in their workplaces. Many people who are no longer with us. There's not enough space in the ground to hide their bodies. Sometimes a park in the street becomes their burial place. I felt that in Syria, I didn't have the right to speak of anything other than the war for the past 9 years. However, I decided to at least look for answers to why all of this happened in Syria. Why Syria? In the United States, people are not very political. Therefore, it really doesn't matter to them what happens in the rest of the world.
CBS News came to this place called Attaf with General Frank McKenzie, commander of U.S. forces in the Middle East.
David, we're standing on the Damascus-Baghdad highway, just inside Syria, and what we're doing here is supporting our partners in the fight against ISIS.
However, not all the people here are American. Some members of Syria's opposition visit the TANF base regularly. Apart from their looks and uniforms, they can be recognized by their Arabic language and their Toyota vans. It appears they are opposed to the Syrian government and have come together to fight the Syrian army. But it appears that their main mission after protecting the American base is controlling the roads that pass through TANF. Of course, the Chinese, in cooperation with many other Asian countries, like Iran, intend to revive the Silk Road. This is a decision which is not secret, as they have talked about it openly on many occasions. Till then, the road linking Baghdad to Damascus, and from there to the Mediterranean coast, is still considered as the Silk Road. Wesley Clark is not the only person who believes the war in Syria was planned long before it started. Many others, like Robert F. Kennedy Jr., also share this belief. He is the nephew of the former President of the United States. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who is both a lawyer and author, published an article in 2016 in Politico magazine entitled "Why Arabs Don't Want Us in Syria." The article stunned many. He writes, "In their view, our war against Bashar Assad did not begin with the peaceful civil protests of the Arab Spring in 2011. In their view, our war against Bashar Assad did not begin with the peaceful civil protests of the Arab Spring in 2011. Instead, it began in 2000, when Qatar proposed to construct a $10 billion, 1,500-kilometer pipeline through Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Syria, and Turkey.
To see whether Kennedy's claims are true or false, we go back to the year 2000. As you are aware, Russia is the biggest producer and exporter of natural gas, with Europe being its biggest customer. The Russians export 70% of their produced natural gas to Europe. The US is highly motivated as it tries to find an alternative to Russia's gas. As a result, they have turned to Qatar and Azerbaijan for gas. But the fact is that Europe's demand for gas could not be met via sea only, and that such a huge supply could only be sent to the continent through a pipeline. This was where the notion of the Qatari gas pipeline was put forth. That's the same energy transit route that would pass through Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and Syria, and then reach Europe via Turkish terminals. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. writes, "In Putin's view, the Qatar pipeline is a NATO plot to change the status quo, deprive Russia of its only foothold in the Middle East, strangle the Russian economy, and end Russian leverage in the European energy market." This plan faced a big obstacle, the Syrian government. Elsewhere in his article, Kennedy writes, "In 2009, Syrians announced that they would refuse to sign the agreement to allow the pipeline to run through Syria to protect the interests of their Russian allies. They also announced commissioning of Russian-approved Islamic pipeline with cooperation from Iran and Iraq. This Islamic pipeline would transport Iran's gas to the Mediterranean through Iraq and Syria, with its final destination being West and Southwestern Europe. The project would become a huge source of revenue for Syria and Iraq, as well as Iran." As a result, all the three countries insisted on its execution. Now, there were problems. On the one hand, Qatar's gas could not be transferred via Syria. On the other hand, Iran would gain a foothold in the European energy market. That's why they decided to remove the problem, namely the Syrian government.
This morning, President Obama called on Assad to step aside and announced the strongest set of sanctions to date targeting the Syrian government. These sanctions include the energy sector to increase pressure on the regime. The transition to democracy in Syria has begun, and it's time for Assad to get out of the way. As President Obama said this morning, no outside power can or should impose on this transition.
Cables released by the whistleblower organization WikiLeaks show that the Israeli, Saudi, and U.S. intelligence agencies started to give financial and intelligence assistance to the groups seeking to topple the Syrian government. This dates back to 2 years before the onset of protests in Syria. Regardless of the WikiLeaks cables, the most optimistic interpretation is that the 2011 protests over economic and political problems in Syria provided an opportunity to implement the Qatar gas pipeline to the Mediterranean by toppling the Assad government. Thus, the protests in Syria soon turned into a full-blown armed conflict, unlike Bahrain and Tunisia, where demonstrations remained peaceful. In a 2016 interview with an Italian news outlet, Bashar Assad explained the issue of the pipeline and the unfolding of the crisis in this way.
Many political analysts think the Syrian no to the pipeline routes proposed by Qatar may be one of the reasons why the war had begun in 2011. How important has been your no to Qatar in the beginning of the war?
It is one of the important factors, but it wasn't offered to us publicly, but I think it was planned. There was two routes crossing Syria. One of them is north-south, which is related to Qatar, as you just mentioned, and the other one was east-west to the Mediterranean that crossed Iraq from Iran. And I don't think many countries who opposed the policy of Syria didn't want Syria to be a hub of power, of energy, whether electricity or oil, or even crossroads of railways and so on.
Later, in an interview with Russia Today, the WikiLeaks founder showed a cable that revealed Saudi Arabia and Qatar were providing military assistance to anti-government armed groups and even ISIS in Syria.
Early 2014 email from Hillary Clinton, so not so long after she left Secretary of State, to her campaign manager, John Podesta. That email, it states that ISIS is funded by Saudi Arabia and Qatar, the governments of Saudi Arabia and Qatar. Now, I think this is the most significant email in the whole collection, and perhaps because Saudi and Qatari money is spread all over the place, including into many media institutions. Under Hillary Clinton, and our Clinton emails reveal significant discussion about it, the largest ever arms deal in the world was made with Saudi Arabia, more than $80 billion.
And of course, the consequence of that is that this notorious terrorist group called ISIL or ISIS is created largely with money from the very people who are giving money to the Clinton Foundation.
It's a belief, but thanks to Trump, we can believe much of these stuff. Do you remember when Donald Trump described ISIS as a creation of Obama and Clinton during his 2016 presidential campaign?
He is the founder of ISIS. He's the founder of ISIS. Okay? He's the founder. He founded ISIS. And I would say the co-founder would be Crooked Hillary Clinton. Co-founder, Crooked Hillary Clinton.
Another person who can easily answer these questions is Qatar's former Prime Minister, Hamad bin Jassim.
There's even questions that have been raised about how much funding Qatar has done to some of the Islamic groups in Syria.
Look, in Syria, everybody did mistakes, including your country. When the war or the revolution happened in Syria, all of us worked through two operation rooms, one in Jordan and one in Turkey. The first one was in Jordan, and there was countries, some of the GCC countries, among them the Saudis, the Emiratis, Qatar, United States, and other allies. And they was working from there. And all of us, we was supporting the same group. In Turkey, we did the same. We discovered by the time, you supported the wrong group sometimes, sure, but you stop. It doesn't mean that we did not do something wrong there.
Whichever way you look at this story, the support of Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey of armed opposition forces in Syria is unequivocal. We should remember that in the US gas project, the Turks and the Saudis would also receive hefty transit duties for allowing the pipeline pass through their territories. The Qataris themselves have admitted this. When relations between Qatar and Saudi Arabia soured, and the Saudis put Qatar under economic and political pressure, Qatari officials tried to place the blame for what happened in Syria on Riyadh. They were not aware that they were admitting to their role in the Syria crisis too.
And at the beginning, and I say this publicly, the beginning, we have the green light from King Abdullah, late King Abdullah, that we lead and they will support us in this. And that was a discussion direct with Abdullah. And then they try to, later they want to change their opinion. They should inform us. We don't mind to be in the back seat and they
wanted
the
to
lead.
Take the lead?
Yeah, we don't mind they take the lead. They are the biggest, big country. We choose to be there because they don't want to appear in the beginning that they are, you know, completely involved. It was easy to change the regime first year.
Easy,
because there was no Russian completely involvement, no Iranian.
There were accusations that Qatar funded al-Nusra, which was linked to al-Qaeda. This happened, yes.
I don't think we have a relation with somebody which United States and all the other allies does not know about it.
In the midst of all this, leaders of some terrorist groups would make statements that would serve as a clue for smart people. Like this one. One of the most prominent propaganda leaders of Jabhat al-Nusra, who was critical of Saudi Arabia for sanctioning Qatar, believes the Qataris were among the biggest supporters of the Syrian opposition from the beginning. The story of the Silk Road and Qatar's pipeline project are not the only reasons for the war on Syria. Just look for US military bases in Syria other than Tanf. From the onset of the war in Syria, all US military bases other than Tanf were established in the country's north and northeast. At the time, the US set up the bases under the pretext of helping Syrian Kurds in the face of attacks by terrorist groups, especially ISIS. The Kurds were content with the US military bases and rejected help from the Syrian army. But in 2019, Trump suddenly announced he was withdrawing US forces from Syria. However, it was later revealed that the United States was not only planning to pull out their troops, but intended to beef up their military presence in places like Tanf.
But we are leaving soldiers to secure the oil. Now, we may have to fight for the oil. That's okay. Maybe somebody else wants the oil, in which case they have a hell of a fight. But there's massive amounts of oil, and we're securing it for a couple of reasons. Number one, it stops ISIS, because ISIS got tremendous wealth from that oil. We have taken it. It's secured. Number two, and again, somebody else may claim it, but either we'll negotiate a deal with whoever's claiming it, if we think it's fair, or we will militarily stop them very quickly. We have tremendous power in that part of the world. We have, the airport is right nearby, a very big, very monstrous, very powerful airport and very expensive airport that was built years ago. We're in that Middle East now for $8 trillion. So we don't want to be...
Let's take a look at this map. Nearly all U.S. military bases are close to Syria's oil-rich areas. Trump justifies the U.S. encircling and extortion of these oil wells by claiming that the United States spent $8 trillion. During his presidency, Trump has frequently vowed to pull out U.S. forces from the Middle East, most particularly Syria. But in the same period, the U.S. has built 6 new bases in northeast Syria.
And one of the things that was brought out by the media, actually, and wisely and correctly brought out, we have very few boats going there anymore because we have our own oil and gas. We don't need it from the Middle East anymore. And that's why we're pursuing a future not only of energy independence, but not just words. You know, you've been hearing energy independence for years and years, and you'd hear it. We have real independence. But what we want now is not independence. We want American energy dominance. Dominance.
All this constitutes only part of the economic motive for Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and the United States to wage a war on Syria. Now the key question is, in light of all the proof, should we keep on thinking that the war in Syria is nothing but an ethno-religious conflict?